Israel 3.
Well, this player conveniently showed us up to the enemy and aided the enemy, but helped us none at all. At one time, the fire was blazing behind me, the truck, and I'd got down to reload a magazine, got up to the top of the mound again to fire over the top, and a big Chinese face was looming at me the other side, just the other side of the single track railway line, and he showed red, and I can remember his Mongolian type beard, and I thought, oh my God, and dropped like a stone. Luckily he did the same and moved up a bit, you know, but we both fired at the same instant, but I'm sure we didn't hit each other, you know. It wouldn't have, it was such a fright seeing this big ugly face. In fact, I always swore I saw him the next day with a bandage, but it could have been another Mongolian. They all look the same. We carried on fighting there, and at this time we had no British officers with us at all in the middle section. In fact, I was the senior corporal in the section, in this particular section. And an American officer was in charge, an American captain further up, and he came running down, a major, I believe, I'm not sure. Anyway, he came running down the road, urging his men to stand their ground because they had now broken into the convoy itself behind some of the damaged trucks and were firing down the road and across the road from both sides, or mainly from our right side, but there were some enemy on the left as well. And it was obvious to me now that they'd encircled the section that we were in. And trucks were being mortared and being set on fire one after the other down the line. This American officer came running back at one time, and he asked us, some of us, to try and take cover for the other side as they were firing from the other side. So I went across with another chappie, and all we could find for cover was a very thin sapling. And I thought, well, being taught any cover is better than none, I've got behind this. And next minute, I hadn't been there a couple of seconds or so, and I saw a flash and a bullet come whizzing across, you see. And then another flash, and a bullet come across. I thought, ah. Oh. By this time, I got my pistol and fired a couple of my rounds from the 45, which obviously hadn't done anything, didn't do any really good, but at least it showed I was awake. And a stream of bullets come flying across. He got a machine gun, and it was a Bren gun that was firing with single shots. And he, you know, so I hopped back the other side quick, where it was cover again, you know, just carried on from there. But they had Bren guns as well. You see, we didn't realise that the Chinese would have been issued with Bren guns, because being a communist country, Czechoslovakia had been selling them Bren guns and all, and they had the most up-to-date Bren guns, we found out later on. Short nozzle, much more advanced than ours at that time. So, anyway, at one period there, an American major came running down the road, and his troops were started pulling back, and he was trying to urge them to go forward down the column to chuck the enemy out from among the vehicles. And we heard him haranguing them, come on, you guys, get on with it. Come up this way more. Come up, we've got to oust them. And the next minute he was hit and killed. And that was it. They all came back and fell back behind us. We were in a terrible state. This American army. Anyway, we carried on fighting away then. We just made a noise. I got rid of my pistol, and I picked up a Thompson submachine gun that one of the wounded had to make a bit more, you know, it's a better weapon. And then we ran out of ammunition for that. And now an American Marine Major, Major McLaughlin, who was a very nice chap later on, I got to know him. He came up and took charge of our section. And he posted us around as best he could. Corporal Kerr by this time was busy looking after the wounded. There were loads of wounded. We had a mixture of everybody in this convoy, South Korean troops, American Army, mostly American Marine Corps and our own people. And he carried on looking after the wounded in the bottom of the ditch, giving them morphine and things like that, which we'd all been issued with. And the rest of us just fired willy-nilly at anything we could see or hear. The Chinese suddenly had captured one of our American sergeant and had released him to our lines to arrange a surrender. They called on us to surrender. And I remember that we ceasefire was called and they gave us an hour. We discussed this and I stood and listened to what they were discussing on the Jeep bonnet. I always remember on an old Jeep bonnet that had been battered. And they were humming and hawing whether to surrender or not. Eventually, Major McLaughlin decided to send a message back telling the Chinese that he would accept their surrender. Crazy, man. And he would supply them with all, if they let us out, he would supply them with all medical equipment and things that they required, you know, for them to. He played a hunch, but it didn't work, of course. They sent a message back and gave him, told him 10 minutes, if he didn't surrender, they would slaughter everybody. And it was unnecessary slaughter, you know, they would just come through us. And it was obvious that there were a great big force in front of us, you know. The noise, it was just out of this world. I never ever expected to hear that sort of sound, you know, with bugles and drums and cymbals. They clanged cymbals for different messages, and it was all very frightening for us. Anyway, at the end of that time, McLaughlin decided to surrender us, and he asked to guarantee that all the wounded would be returned and things like that, and they did just that. All the severely wounded, the Chinese just came through. Just came through the convoy and they were sort of looting everything they could find, really. I mean, one of them had my denim. I used to have a Denison smock. Do you know what a Denison smock is? Used to call them jumping jackets, and in our days they used to camouflage jacket. They used to clip up underneath. And
underneath your crotch?
And it was quite a good piece of clothing to wear, really. Anyway, that next day I saw that being worn by, because we used to have our names on the back of them, and I saw that being worn by Chinese. So they were after everything they could find to pinch in the convoy. But they never took, to my knowledge, they never took off anything from any of the prisoners. As they came up to me, I had my pistol back by now, because we'd run out of ammunition for the rest of the weapons. In fact, I didn't have any ammunition for the pistol by this time. So I'd taken the firing pin out and thrown it away. And as they came through, we put our hands up, you see. My pistol was in my belt. Put my hands up with all the rest of them. And they, okay. And they pushed all our hands down. Wouldn't have us with our hands up. And took the weapon. Never even looked at it to see if I'd taken the firing pin out there. And he just took that. And they were so pleased that we'd given up, you know. And I thought, well, this is a peculiar setup, you know. I thought we were going to be battered or shot at the worst. Anyway, they herded us all together.
How did they show their pleasure at your surrender?
Oh, shook hands and everything, you know, pulled our hands down and shook hands. Okay, you know. Didn't know what to do even then, you know. Keep putting our hands up. But we thought they'd be sort of gun-happy people, because I couldn't see the Americans doing that, you know. I'd be more frightened of it than fighting the Americans, to be quite honest. So anyway, the commander got us all together and spoke to us in broken English, told us we were going to move back to a prison camp, and we would be looked after. Nothing will be taken and no harm will come to us, you know. All our severely wounded will be returned. And I think, as far as I know, they were. They kept their word.
Sent back to the Allied lines?
Yes, to the American lines. Now, I can't guarantee that, but as far as I know, they were, you know. But anyway, we were herded together and we started to march back straight away, early morning by now. And as we were marching back, as the light came up, we saw the American aircraft, great big goods carriers, dropping supplies, parachute supplies, to the 1st Marine Division, which was at Haguru Rhee, which had been surrounded. And we didn't realise that they were fighting for their life up there, even. That was a whole division. I mean, that's about, I should imagine, about 30,000 or 40,000 men in their division. And they were dropping supplies to them as we started to march back. We had one or two walking wounded with us. And one or two of those, of course, died later on. Minor wounds, like leg wound or arm wound, they wouldn't release them, you know. We asked for them to release them, right, but they wouldn't have that. Treatment was reasonable. I mean, they just hurried us along, but not nobody was battered or anything, to my knowledge. The next day after that, we'd got up and we started to walk again. We had a few hours sleep on the side of the road business, and then we walked away. And suddenly, one of our SBAs appeared. I was in the middle of this column of prisoners, and there was a chap called Dennis Raines. I don't know if you want to mention his name. And he'd been so badly wounded, all his face was shot away, LSBA Raines. And he asked for a drink of water, and he'd been wandering around all the ever since the battle, you know. And nobody picked him up. Always, he would never have walked a couple of more yards, you know. He was that badly wounded, and you couldn't even give him a drink because he never had a mouth to drink from. Really, it was all blown away on one side. It was a terrible sight, and he's still conscious. So we asked the Chinese if they would look after him. And they said they would, and they put him into a warm house because it was freezing cold as well. And that's the last we heard on, but he died. He would have died anyway, I think. And I don't think they killed him, you know. I mean, I think he was probably put into a warm house and just died naturally. I mean, I can't say how a man could have lived with that wound like that. I was so surprised that he was conscious and walking around. Anyway, we carried on our walking north, and we used to have to hide up during the day and walk mainly at night from after the battle, because the American aircraft were very busy and they used to strafe everything that was moving. And every little Korean house that we passed by was obliterated. You know, the devastation. It's mainly farms and hill people, and it was so terrible. I mean, every little farm and cottage had been burned or destroyed by napalm or something, you know, shot up. Where they were living, I couldn't, you know, we just couldn't understand. We used to sleep out in the cold. And there was nowhere really for us to go.
Did you approve of that or disapprove of it?
Well, this happens in warfare. I thought it was a bit harsh, you know, the way it had been treated. We found several American helicopters that had been shot down. Two or three of them we passed. They used to use those for spotting and things, you know. They were the early type of helicopters. And they weren't all that valuable to them, I don't think. They seem to lose quite a few of those.
Did the airstrike seem to be effective as far as interdicting the movement of the troops was concerned?
Not at all. Not at all. The further north we got, you see, the troop movements were made overnight. And the Americans used to come over with their B-25s, dropping flares all over the place. And at one time, when we were on the march back, we were in the column and we'd come to a bridge over a river. And we were just about to cross over this weir with our Chinese guards. And we were stopped, halted on the side of the road by the bridge. And a huge column of Chinese infantry came over. And they're all carrying their bars, I can't think what they call them there, with the cooking pots hanging from either end, you know, and all their equipment.
The woks, are they called?
Well, those sort of thing, yeah, but I can't think what they call their...
A yoke,
yeah, something like a yoke, but they carry it on one shoulder, you know. And that's, you see, they carry everything with them, whereas we've got supply vehicles and things like that to bring all our stuff, you know, the Chinese man. They all have a sachet of grain to carry. Sorghum they ate out there, which is a dreadful grain. We had to eat it later on. It was dreadful stuff. It's like old red barley, it looks like, but it's always rough and coarse old muck. I think they feed it to cattle in the West. Anyway, they carry their food and for several days, you know, and this they can eat and live on that sort of thing. Well, of course, Americans and even us found it a bit difficult to live on that sort of stuff. But all their movements were going on at night. Well, this plane came over and he dropped the flares and there were the American, the Chinese continually crossing the bridge and he never dropped any bombs on it. We thought, this is our lot. He's bound to spot all. But he didn't, thank goodness, otherwise we would have been here to tell the story, I don't think. But there's thousands of them. And the horses, ponies, loads of cavalry, Chinese cavalry, you know, it was unbelievable. We thought, surely American army against this lot, you know. But they're so efficient. They were very efficient soldiers. And don't forget, they'd been used to fighting the Japanese and the Kuomintang, the nationalist Chinese at the end. And they were really efficient at guerrilla warfare.
In what way were they efficient?
Well, they can, as I say, they can exist on grain and things like that that we couldn't really live on. The foods that they had, we couldn't live on that sort of thing. Their stamina, is, I would say, is far beyond the Westerner because they seem to travel at a rate. Well, it's just unbelievable to see them. I mean, they can move so fast and that they walk, and they use their forces in such a wasteful way to us, I suppose, because they know that the more they've got the amount of manpower to throw in without noticing the trouble. You know, I mean, whereas in a unit like ours, say with about 200 people, if we lost half of those, it would be dreadful. But if you've got so many million men, lose half of them, you've still got a few million left. And they say that, they used to say, if you was to shoot all the Chinese, if all the American army and that was in the world, was firing against the Chinese, by the time they'd shot the last one, another generation had arisen. There's 1,000 million people now, isn't it? They had a lot of manpower. But anyway, we were quite well treated by the Chinese and we were moved along at a reasonable rate. I suppose they pushed us as much as possible to get back out of the lines. Where we went to, I don't know, but it was uphill and downhill and it's all hills. And we used to be so thankful when the journey come to an end, you know. Worn, really worn out. I mean, by this time, of course, we were only getting one ball of rice or sorghum a day, and it was cold. And one, they used to make it into a ball and hand that out, one a day, and that's all we were living on. Eventually, we were handed over to North Koreans, and this was a different kettle of fish. They were We didn't realise they were North Koreans. We thought, Russians. They had pillbox hats with a knob on the top and Sam Browns, blue uniforms, and they all carried the machine guns over their shoulders, you know. And the Korean commander was very nasty to us. He made us stand up there, and we were a mixture of all sorts, and we had to number off. And well, if you've ever heard the Americans, hip, hop, hip, hop, this sort of thing, you know. We were saying, four, five, because it was all wrong. He wanted to count to see how many there were. And we were stood out there this evening, all for ages, before he'd let us go for a sleep. You know, one morning, actually. We'd been marching all night, and we'd made us stand there until we got it done right, you know. Of course, it just didn't work. We had Koreans with us and all sorts, you know. We went over and over and over again, and he was really getting haranguing us. And he was doing this through a Japanese, an American. He used to speak Japanese to the American, who was a prisoner of war of Japan during the war, and he'd picked up Japanese. And he was translating back into English for us. Oh, it was dreadful. Anyway, we eventually got done, you know. But they never really ill-treated us. But by this time, I'd got a couple of blisters on my heel. And through these snow packs, I mean, they were new things, and they'd worn a couple of blisters on my heel, and I was hobbling. And I was nearly always one of the last to come into the column, you know, with a gutler guard. Give me a couple of bashes up the back with the old butt. You know, they weren't really hurting me. Get on, you know. They never really loved us, of course. And but they weren't very bad to us. Anyway, you say, oh, come on, Richards, for goodness sake, Condren should have told you all this. Hurry up in. And I've always suffered with numb feet through cold, and fingers always used to go dead, you know. And Andy used to take my boots off and rub my feet.
This is Andy Condren.
Andy Condren used to rub my, because to get circulation back, and it was, if they were wet, you see, from the sweat of the insoles, and then they would freeze. And I say a lot of people later on died with frostbite, because it froze and lost their toes and feet. One of our Marines died of that, actually, later.
Why do you think there was a difference in the way the North Koreans treated you from the Chinese?
Well, it's their country that was being obliterated, and I could understand that. In fact, I would have expected worse treatment, really. We were always told, you know, before going out to Korea, that they didn't take prisoners anyway. I mean, a lot of the American propaganda that was put out was that they found their prisoners with hands tied behind the back with wire and all this sort of thing, shot in the head. Well, we all fully expected that sort of treatment, you know, but it didn't occur. So it was really propaganda. But I would expect the Koreans, I mean, I could realise, if it had been my country that had been attacked or something like that, I wouldn't have been so kind, I don't think. So I expected that. But the Chinese, of course, were foreigners the same as we were. And but they're still a more trustworthy race to me, Chinese. I trust the Chinese anywhere. I mean, I've seen, you know, things we've done later on were things that British servicemen wouldn't have put up with, let alone an enemy, you know, like the Chinese.
How do you mean?
Well,
what things are you referring to?
Well, I was going to bring it up later when we got to a place called Kangyi, which was a small town in Korea, which was already been set up. When we arrived there, it was already burning. The Americans had bombed it again, and we were going to be billeted there. We found one or two little outhouses that hadn't been badly damaged, and we were put in there. The civilians were taken out. I don't know where they went to, but we were put into these houses. One or two of the civilians stayed. And While we were billeted there, we used to be allowed outside of the huts with the Chinese guard outside. And the kiddies from their village used to come out, and they had sledges they'd made, old wooden-type sledges, and we used to run down the hill and watch them, you know. We asked the guard, okay, to play with them, you know, and they allowed us to play with the kids, pushing them down. And one old guard, he had his rifle. He was a fairly old person to us at that time, you know, middle-aged, and we were only youngsters, of course, 20-ish. 20-odd, and he had his rifle on his shoulder, and he was watching us there, and he was happy, laughing away at us, pushing the kids down and having rides ourselves. We asked him if he'd ever like to have a go, and he loved it. Handed his rifle over to to us, and we took him on the hill, pushed him out of the sledge and hit his rifle. You know, that sort of thing. I mean, we'd never ever do that to... he wasn't... He was a bit upset at first, you know, but he took it all in good part. We had to give it back to him, obviously. I mean, it was nowhere to go anyway.
You were just teasing him.
That's it, yeah. But, you know, he took it all in good fun, really, later on. He got a bit worried at first. So he said, no rifle. And while we were in Kangi, we were stuck there, you know, and we got talking to a Korean civilian. One of the very few who was living in his house. He said he was a teacher. We managed to get that from him in broken English. And we asked, you know, he asked him exactly what was happening. We couldn't get much from him, but as far as we understood, he thinks the Americans were coming. You know, he kept saying, Americans coming, and this sort of thing. Of course, they weren't. They were going the other way, really. We didn't know that then. And while we were there, we started getting lectures and things by the Chinese on communism, of course, and why we shouldn't have been in Korea and all that sort of thing. And I'd, as I say, got very bad feet by now. They'd gone poisoned, and my foot was swollen right up, and there was no doctors, and we had no doctor with us. We were only a handful of British men. I think there were 17 of us captured. I'm not sure of the number. But we were the only group of British there, you see. And they used to go off on the lectures, and I used to get out of it by being sick. So I used to stay in the hut at the back, you know. And while they were out, I used to try and get food, and I sold my G10 watch, issue watch, for a bit of Korean toffee off of an old lady who was living in a little hut. And crept over to a house. They left sort of one guard on the whole batch of places, houses, while the rest were away at their lecture. And I crept over, got out of his sight, and crept over to this old lady's house and took a watch on. Mongria, you know, we didn't know what the term was, but Arab for... I knew what an Arab term was, food, you know. We kept saying food, so I kept saying food to her. And she said, whoa. And then eventually she came out with a note. She gave me this Korean note, you see.
Currency note?
Yeah. And it was 1,000 won. I think it was 1,000 or 100 won. It was a one note, anyway, 1,000 won, I think it was. And I thought, oh, this must be worth something, you see. So I give it to her. No food, you see, something to eat, but we were really hungry. And so she gave me a lump of toffee. And